en coloc. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Academy.
De quelle manière les minéraux sont-ils des acteurs du développement durable ? Comment se forment-ils ? Comment se dégradent-ils ? Quels échanges entretiennent-ils avec le vivant ? Lors du colloque sur la minéralogie environnementale des 14 et 15 septembre 2009 à l'Académie des sciences, plusieurs chercheurs se sont intéressés à la partie solide de la Terre et géosphère sous l'angle de ses relations avec l'hydrosphère, fleuve et océan, et la biosphère, la vie. Canal Academy vous retransmet en deux parties quelques-unes de ses interventions en langue anglaise. Vous entendrez Emmanuel Fritsch, directeur de recherche IRD à l'Institut de minéralogie et de physique des milieux condensés à Paris, évoquer la formation et la dégradation spectaculaire des sols amazoniens. Sabine Petit, directeur de recherche au CNRS et directeur adjoint de l'unité Hydrasa, s'attardera sur le rôle crucial des minéraux argileux dans les sols. Enfin, Joseph Stucky, professeur émérite du département des ressources naturelles et des sciences environnementales de l'Université de l'Illinois, évoquera l'état du fer qui affecte la fertilité des sols.
I'm pleased to present some results of our work carried out in the Amazon basin on soil forming and soil change processes in lateritic landscape, and focusing more specifically on the chemistry and or speciation of Fe and Al in this tropical soil. This work were funded by various French and Brazilian programs associating the University of São Paulo, mainly the University of São Paulo, and l'Institut de Minéralogie et de Physique des Milieux Condensés. First of all, I would like to remind some major characteristics of the Amazon basin. It's one of the largest basins of the world. It's located in the humid tropical region, so related to deeply weathering conditions leading to the residual accumulation and, of iron and aluminium in soil. It's a domain of the laterites. So it's also known in the various soil classification as a feral soil, oxysoil, or latosoil. It's also a major reserve of fresh water in the world. So that explains the large extent of waterlogged soil. This basin is associated also to tremendous flux of water and matter to the ocean, showing that there is active erosion and weathering process acting nowadays. The basin also is the support of tropical forests, and thus it plays a major role in the regulation of climate and the cycle of major elements such as carbon, iron and aluminium. The objectives of the work are resumed in this slide. The first is to reveal the main landform and weathering and erosion processes of the Amazon basin using broad-scale geological soil and vegetation map, to probe the structure of mineral and organic matter to better characterize such processes along representative soil catena, and to relate this process to major hydrological regime and geochemical cycle, and also to link the soil dynamic to stratigraphic event of the cenozoic and to water quality in a river system. A broad-scale soil map of the Radam Brazil project shows the spatial distribution of the soil, of the major soil in the basin, with freely drained soil at the periphery of the basin in red, which is associated to the residual accumulation of iron and aluminium. And when you go towards the central part of the basin, in upstream position of this basin, you have a progressive land degradation with a soil yellowing, a clay depletion, but also development of waterlogged conditions, thus a redoxomorphing, ultimately a podzolization. These land degradation processes are associated also to the redistribution and exportation of mainly iron and aluminium to the river system. I would like also to remind you some major cenozoic event in the basin, with first major sedimentation in the Pacific embayment at the beginning of the tertiary, followed by phase of erosion and peneplanation, during the formation of the Andean Cordillera and ultimately to the late sedimentation in the late Tertiary and associated to the formation Isa. One of the major events is also the birth of the modern Amazon River system about 2.5 million years ago, with the incision of the lowland mainly associated to the Isa surface and the Ucayali peneplain. Lateritic formation are, according to a soil survey, very thin on the Isa formation. They are, in contrast, very thick and commonly faulted on formation of the Ucayali peneplain, such as those studied in the Manaus region. Here you have a cross-section of the soil in this region. We are in this region, we have characterized the detailed crystallographic change from the bottom to the upper part of this lateritic profile, which consists mainly of kaolinite and iron oxide. Alors, for kaolinite, crystallographic changes were investigated mainly by EPR and their spectroscopy, and both methods show a gradual change in the shape of the spectra from bottom to top of this lateritic profile, which were related to increasing proportion of stacking fault in kaolinite and also associated to this decreasing size of kaolinite particle, which is quite efficient at the transition in at depths between saprolite and soil. This suggests changing condition of formation with conditions which are favorable to the formation of low defect crystal at depths, and a condition which in contrast are favorable to the formation of stacking fault. And thus, we suggest the mechanism of dissolution and precipitation of kaolinite with associated to the decrease of the size of this kaolinite. We have also used EPR spectroscopy to try to date this population of kaolinite using radiation-induced defect. This was illustrated yesterday by Georges Callas. You can see on the EPR spectra the signal associated to radiation-induced defect, which is more or less expressed. And with this signal, amplitude of the signal, with calibration curve, you can measure the parallel dose, which is proportional to the dose rate, so the quantity of radio element in the soil over time. If you consider that the dose rate does not change with time, you see that kaolinite age is related to the ratio between the parallel dose and the dose rate. We applied this method to this profile and show that sediment have an age of more than 25 million years and an age of about 6 million years in the upper part of the profile, thus suggesting slow transformation or dissolution, crystallization of kaolinite, as suggested previously. We also, for iron oxide, we study the crystallographic changes using a refinement of DRX spectra, but also visible and Mossbauer spectroscopy. These changes are also related in the field to upward yellowing, which was associated here to the decreasing proportion and size of hematite and increasing proportion and aluminium substitution of goethite. Both mineralogical train, we try to estimate this change on the on this profile by deconvoluting the, for example, for kaolinite, the EPR of tear spectra using a spectra of a low defect and high defect kaolinite, and the same thing for iron oxide between hematite, goethite, and aluminium goethite. And we show that The crystallographic change are marginal for carbonate at depths, and more specifically at the transition between saprolite and soil, whereas those affecting the hyaluronic oxide occur mainly in the upper part of the profile. When we associated the mineralogical and geochemical change in this profile, we can show that the formation of laterite is a two-step processes. With first at depth, where you can see there is no loss or gain of iron and aluminium, but loss of silica, which suggests a dissolution of quartz, and we relate this part of the profile to successive dissolution or crystallization of carbonate. And you can see that in the upper part of the profile, we have the loss of aluminium, and which is associated to a depletion of clay. So yellowing is associated to a loss of carbonate. And therefore, we suggest that the conditions are no longer in this part of the profile favorable to the crystallization of carbonate, but to the formation of aluminium goethite and the apparition in the profile of small amount of gypsite. The clay depletion, what is the special distribution of this clay depleted laterite at a large scale? Soil surveys show that the clay depleted soil are mainly located on the low elevation plateau and at the periphery of the pozolic area. And when you go from the river incision or the border of the plateau towards this pozolic area, you have a progressive modification of the morphology of the soil with soil yielding and depletion of clay. Thus, using mass balance modeling, we show that the laterite, more than 90 or 95% of the aluminium supply are lost in this clay depleted laterite, and that this clay depletion is necessary to the development of pozzol in this landscape. Pozzolic formation are mainly present in the upper part of the basin and in the Negro River, mainly in the Negro water, River watershed, where they occupy more or less 33% of the superficie of the watershed. There, in downstream position, this pozzol has weakly developed in the plateau and mainly localized in the depression of this plateau, whereas in the north part and upstream position of this basin, you can see that pozzol much expanded, widely expanded in the landscape. So we have selected two sites, one in the downstream position, it's a Jaou site, and the other one in the upstream position with pozzol is quite developed. It's a Curie-Curiari site. Pozzolization is mainly associated to accumulation of organic matter and low mineralization rate due to the development of waterlogged condition in this soil. It's also associated to the weathering of the remaining clay minerals and the formation from the weathering of the clay depleted laterite, and also associated to formation, translocation, and accumulation of organic metallic complex with mainly Al and Fe. This leads to residual accumulation of beach sand and large production of dissolved organic carbon, black organic colloids in soil and river. Here is an example in the Jaou site of a topo sequence between clay depleted soil and pozzol. This is the soil differentiation is a result from the expansion of the pozzol laterally into the laterite. And this process is a two-step one, with first massive accumulation of organic matter in the clay depleted laterite, the margin of the pozzolic area, where you form what we call the BH S horizon, and secondly, toward the downslope position, you have apparition of the perched groundwater and sandy soils with the formation of greater depth of other horizon with rich in organic matter. You have two types of horizon, one which is in black. It's a BH, what we call the BH horizon. It's an accumulation of matter at the bottom of the sandy reservoir and a greater depth. We have what we call the BS or BCS horizon. It's an accumulation of fine organic matter in a less clay depleted material. Anyway, we have investigated the structure of this organic matter by NMR spectroscopy, and these studies show a strong contrast of organic compound with mainly aliphatic carbon in organic residue of the topsoils and in the upper part of this graphic. And we have mainly also carbohydrate and carboxylic acid in the BHS and greater depth in the BS horizons. And in contrast, the apparition of a greater aromacity in the BH horizon of this profile, which are in black on the left section of the profile. We have also tried to date this organic compound, and on the left hand side, in upslope position on the graphic, you see that you have an increasing in the age of the organic matter with depth, which is asymptotic and reach about 2,500 years at 2 meter depth in the laterite. And when you go from the laterite on the left of this cross-section to the puzzle on the right, you can see on the right graphic that in the deep horizon, the BS horizon, you have a gradual increase of the age of this organic matter, which is very progressive, whereas in the overlying BH horizon, the organic matter is much younger, it's two black dots. This increase at depth of the edge of this puzzle can show either that we have a younger puzzle at the border of this puzzolic area, an older one in the center of this depression. It may also result of a greater residence of organic matter in a better waterlogged soil, such as those encounter in the low-lying depression of this landscape. We have also investigated the organic AL complex by RMN spectroscopy, with example on this of RMN spectra. And this study shows that these complexes are mainly accumulated at the margin of the podzolic area in two places, mainly at depth at the bottom of the BHS horizon and downstroke at greater depth in the BS horizon of podzol. And the results are quite consistent with selective chemical extraction. And we also show, it's not shown in this slide, that organic AL complex are much less abundant in a low-lying position. We did the same thing for the organo-FA complex using a PR spectroscopy. And you can see here on the EPR spectra, the signal associated to dilated RN and then others to the formation of this complex. We see also that on this slide that this organic effect complex is quite relatively abundant at the margin of the depression. This is two on this slide, and much less abundant in low-lying position. But you can see also that they are mainly present closer from the surface in the transition zone, in the upper part of the BS RHS horizon, or in the in low-lying position at greater depth in the BH horizon. A comparison of both shows first that you have a much larger amount of aluminium than Fe bound to organic compounds. If you look at the x-axis, you see that you have more or less 10 times larger amount of aluminium than iron, three bound to organic matter. You can see also that the organic RL complex are accumulated at a greater depth in comparison of organic Fe complex, both in the weakly developed puzzle at the transition or at greater depth in better developed puzzle. Donc, this suggests that you have a physical fractionation of this organic Fe and RL complex, likely due to particular size and to a textural contrast at the bottom of this puzzle, with accumulation of fine particle or dissolved organic carbon bound to aluminium in the BS horizon, for example, a accumulation of black and greater organic particle size with mainly Fe in the BH horizon of this puzzle. We have also investigated the geochemistry of groundwater along this toposequence using piezometry. And you can see that from upslope position, also from the clay depleted lateral to the downslope position of this toposequence that is in prozole, that on the graphic you have a progressive decrease of silica. Both graphic relate the relation between silica or an Fe or RL in the groundwater. And you can see that you have this decrease of silica, which is mainly due to a dilution effect and due to the quick recharge and discharge of the groundwater, or the perch groundwater, in this sandy soil of pozole. This graphic also shows for iron that you have mainly mobilization of iron, not in the pozole, but in the groundwater in upslope position, not close to this pozolic area. The mobilization does not really occur in this pozole, but in the clay depleted lateral, as pozole are quite depleted in iron. In contrast, aluminium is mainly mobilized in the lateral weathering front due to probably to the weathering of clay mineral, mainly kaolinite and gypsite in this profile. We have also investigated the Fe content and redox status in groundwater and surface water in the Rio Negro watershed. And this graphic is quite interesting, that you can see it relates the Fe2 plus present in this water versus the total Fe. And the plain black line is associated to a complete reduction of iron in this water, where the Fe2 plus equals the total Fe. You can see from this graphic that the development of pozole in this landslide landscape. It's mainly associated to strong development of reducing condition and also to dilution effect. You can see that both in the soils and in the river. In the soil, in the upper part, you can see that in the low-lying position, the dots on the left of the graphic, you can see that you have a low quantity of iron, but all is in the form of Fe2+. Whereas at the transition on the right side, you have a slightly greater amount of iron, and a decrease of Fe2+ proportion in this water. In the surface water, the main river of this watershed, you can see that in upstream position of the watershed where pozzola are quite developed, that is, for example, in the Curicuri basin, that you have a low content of Fe2, but it's mainly in the form low content of total Fe, but it's mainly reduced. And when you go in downstream position where pozzola are less developed, you can see that you have greater amount of total Fe and but less proportion of Fe2 in the water. Thus, it's quite interesting that this dot line shows that we can, from chemical investigation in the river, have an idea of the extent of this process of pozzolization in the landscape. That also some investigation we have done from the pozzol to the Black River system. The two sides relate the mixing of, on the left, of a clear and black water between a lateritic and pozzolic area, and on the right photo, it's a famous encounter of water, the Encuentras las Aguas, where you have the mixing of the Rio Negro on the right and the Solimões water at the Manaus site. From the BH of the horizon of pozzol to the black organic colloid in river, you see from this EPR spectroscopy that the signal on your left is quite important in the BH horizon, this signal on the left in gray is weakly expressed in BH horizon of pozzol, but is quite more developed in a colloid of river. And we can see also that the free radical, the right signal on the graphic, disappear in progressively disappear in the river system. So the organic matter is bleached. This shows that we have probably a change in the chemistry of this water, with probably development of oxidizing condition. What are the minor controls of this soil dynamic? In the Amalytic Basin, you can see that the land degradation and formation of pozzola are mainly associated to higher rainfall area in the basin. The second control is mainly stratigraphy. We can see from this world-scale soil maps that the pozzola are weakly developed in the landscape on the ISA formation, and mainly associated to the ramified depression. Whereas on the Ucali peneplain, pozzol may be quite developed in the landscape. It's 2 and 3 in this soil map. What are the effects of the incision of the quite extended waterlogged pozzol in the upstream position of the Rio Negro watershed? First, it's lowering the groundwater, and thus reacting the mineralization of organic matter at the weathering front, thus restricting the spatial expansion of pozzol in the landscape. And erosion may also reactivate the pozzolization in low-lying position and also feed the main river corridor in bleaching in major sediment trap. We have thus proposed a global model of soil landscape evolution. This is the Amazon basin. And we show from these studies a puzzle mainly developed from former lowland of the Issa Formation or Ucayali peneplain. We have expansion of weathering processes from poorly drained area or depression with clay depletion and ultimately podzolization, but also incision from the river. And on the left-hand side of this slide, you have three steps which are related to the evolution of these processes in downstream position of this watershed. On the right-hand side of this slide, it's in the upstream position, donc where the puzzle are quietly and widely incised by erosion. So I just wanted to show you that an integrated study from mineral to continental scale can give major information of this contrasted weathering environment, which have significant effect and also major geochemical cycle. Thank you for your attention.
Donc, de plus, dans un tel lieu et en tant que seule oratrice de ces deux jours, je me sens très fière et honorée, mais aussi un peu isolée. Donc, il me plaît à penser que la place libre au-dessus soit réservée pour une personnalité éminente féminine. OK. Now I will switch to French language. I think it is a good compromise between both languages. So, I associated as co-author Dominique Rigui, who is now retired and who is an expert in clay minerals in soils, and it is more or less this lecture is more or less dedicated to him. So we had many, many fruitful discussions about clay minerals in soils. As all of you know, our life on Earth is supported by the fragile skin of the planet, defined from the outer extent of vegetation down to the lower limits of groundwater. And this volume has been recently labeled the critical zone because of its essential role in natural and managed ecosystems. And the critical zone is a big engine with many overlapped processes: biological weathering, physical weathering, chemical weathering, and there is climate forcing, anthropogenic forcing, tectonic forcings, and it will give a atmospheric response, river ocean response, and soil sediment response. And we are working there. That means this is very important to interpret the record, and we are focused on soil response record. And this is a schematic representation of the soil system with a reactive surface. And there is organic matter, so parent material, porous parent material, because it is in the way to be altered. This is a clay aggregate, so this is a typical soil aggregate. And this is clay particle with bacterial enzyme. This is clay particle with organic matter, and this is some carbonate or oxide minerals. And in a soil, so you have parent minerals, and the weathering will create secondary minerals, which are clay minerals, means it's minerals with size less than 0.2 micrometer. And depending on the strongness of the strength of weathering, you will have different type of minerals. So 2-1 phyllosilicates, that means that you have two silica sheets with an octahedral sheet. 1-1 phyllosilicates, so one silica sheet, one octahedral sheet, and oxide or oxyhydroxide. And all of you know, and thank you, George Pedro, this global distribution of clay minerals at the Earth's surface. So this is a lateritic zone with mainly kaolinite and oxide or oxide, and depending to the climate, if it is not too cold, you will have 2-1 phyllosilicate in the other regions. So this is a very schematic, but this is a global scale. But we have to note that we can find such also such differentiation at a microscopic scale. For example, this is amphibole crystals from amphibolite rocks from Massif Central France. And if we look at this grain as a microscopic scale, you can see this amphibole crystals and altered by, and you can see clay mineral formation there. And if you look this sample with scanning electron microscope, you can see clearly clay minerals and weather amphibole. But you can distinguish between different types of clay minerals. This is here monzonite, here saponite. And even you can see kaolinite, smectite there, halozite. So this is other picture, kaolinite, smectite, and halozite. So you can find all these clay minerals for one grain of amphibole crystal. So because it exists microsite. So it's not so simple. And now, this is the soil system, very resumed. And you have vegetation and rainforest and exchange of cations. And the main processes are exchange, acidification, alteration. And one physico-chemical property which is very important is a cation exchange capacity. And thus I will make a short recall about that. The cation exchange capacity is defined as a quantity of cations reversibly adsorbed per unit weight of minerals. You, all of you know that. But it corresponds to the property to exchange cations from the surface of minerals by cations in solution. And it is issued from the structural charge of mineral, which is the sum of two types of charges. So, as we saw yesterday, this is pH dependent charge by protonation or deprotonation of species at edges. And just to remind you, to apply this to clay structure. So this is 2-1 structure and 1-1 structure. You'll have broken edge. And depending to the pH, you will have different charge. And these charges are edge charge, pH dependent, and they are also named variable charge. In contrast to permanent charge, which are pH independent and due to heterovalent isomorphous substitutions. In smectite, for example, in a tetrahedral sheet, which is mainly composed by silica, you can have heterovalent substitution by trivalent cations, aluminium, iron, it could be also gallium and so on. And in the octahedral sheet, you can have trivalent cations, but substitution with divalent cations. So this is magnesium, iron, it could be nickel, cobalt, zinc, and so on. And sometimes you can also have substitution of divalent cation by monovalent, which is lithium. And of course, it can exist vacant site. And this heterovalent substitution will induce negative charge, which will be compensated by interlayer cations. So, and the permanent charge is there, is the sum of the tetrahedral charge and the octahedral charge. Okay, and for smectite, the permanent charge is higher than variable charge. And coming back to this schematic representation, under proton activity, it can occur cations leaching. In soil, you can find organisms, enzymes, bacteria, and so on, organic matter. And the role of clay minerals in soil will be to neutralize the acidification due to this proton release, the control of the cations flux, which are plant nutrients. They can have a role in the preservation of or biodegradation of organic matter. And thus it is very important to know the relationship between conditions of formation, crystal chemistry, and reactivity of clay minerals. And to solve this problem, we can study the natural soil system. However, it is complex, and the process is not necessarily understood. And we can do experimental study, so laboratory experiments with minerals alteration mimicking natural weathering. And we can also do clay synthesis to better determine the link between conditions of formation of clay minerals and their crystal chemistry and reactivity. And I will give you an example of a complex system, soil system, natural soil system, and how we perform experimental laboratory mineral alteration to try to understand the process. And after that, I will give you some example of clay synthesis. So this is an example of vertisol from Sardinia. And we studied the fine fraction, so minus 0.1 micrometer fraction. And so this is the sea horizon and the upper horizon. They are not very different. We can observe an elitic part and smectitic part, okay. And the cation exchange capacity is very similar for all samples. And the permanent charge 2, variable charge 2. But if we study this smectite in detail, so determine the part of tetrahedral and octahedral charge, we can see some difference. I mean that sea horizon are less tetrahedrally charged, the smectite of sea horizon are less tetrahedrally charged than the upper horizon. So access means accessible. That means that this is a component of cation exchange capacity. And of course, concomitantly, the octahedral charge is higher in this sea horizon. That means that in the sea horizon, smectite are more monomeric. Okay. And this is in total accordance with infrared and chemical analysis. On infrared spectra, we can see that in the sea horizon, we can see clearly an aluminium magnesium OH band, which is less intense in the upper horizon. And the aluminium iron band is higher, more intense in the upper horizon. So this is in total accordance with the chemical analysis. And just to show you how we can see this small difference in chemical composition through the infrared spectra. It's okay. And after several treatments, different treatments, rather long in laboratory, we can determine the different proportion of type of layers. So the layers which with a tetrahedral charge lower than 0.24, and the layer with a tetrahedral charge higher than 77. So this is high charge layer and low charge layer, tetrahedral charge. And so we can see clearly that the layer with a rather low tetrahedral charge, so rather monomeric layer, decrease in the upper horizon. And the tetrahedral, the high charge layer, increase in the upper horizon. So, okay, we can observe thus an increase of high charge, elitic-like bedelitic layers. But what is the process? So, either these layers are formed, either they are relatively remaining one. So we don't know. Thus we tried to do some experimental alteration in laboratory to try to understand the process. So we took the sample smectat from the sea horizon, so the not smectat, but the less than 0.1 micrometer fraction. And we submitted this sample to wetting and drying cycles. We have three series of samples, 10 wetting and drying cycles, 50 and 100. And after the last cycle, we freeze-dry the sample and stored them in glass bottles under vacuum. And we use also one other sample, which is Chaiteau Momeronite, which is a well-known reference Momeronite to compare. And this is the infrared spectra. What we can observe is a carbonate precipitation for the 100 for the high number of cycles, 50 and 100, so there. That means that there is sodium and maybe magnesium leaching because the signal is not very high. We cannot distinguish between the nature of carbonates. We can also observe this band, the appearing of this band, which is due to hydroxyaluminium polycation. That means that there is some aluminium leaching. So this is a X-ray diffraction pattern. So this is an initial sample, so calcium saturated and ethylene glycol solvated. And we can see several components, smectite, so this is a 0.02 reflection. And elite smectite, so elite is not the actual term, it is elitic layers with 70% of elite and an elitic phase. And when the number of wetting drying cycles increase, we can see a decrease of the smectite component and an increase of the elitic component. So this is clearly seen there. So this is the same sample, but alkyl ammonium intercalated. So alkyl ammonium is a chain with a number of carbon. In this case, it is 12 carbon. And depending to the characteristic of charge, the chain will be more or less inclined. And thus, the distance measure, the interlayer distance measure, is linked to the charge. And so this is an experimental diffractogram, and this is a model diffractogram. And we can modelize correctly this diffractogram with this value. So this is, we can see clearly that the proportion of the ratio of smectite decrease with the wetting and drying number of cycles there. So this is a 30% smectite and 70% elite smectite. And for the 100 wetting and drying experiment, we have 10% smectite and 90% elite smectite. Okay. If we measure the accessible permanent charge, we can see a clear decrease. Okay. It means that there is a, yes, this is a, in accordance with a relative increase of elitic layers. And this is also in accordance with a non-exchangeable hydroxyaluminium cation in the interlayer. And the external surface area increase with an increase of the number of wetting and drying cycles. And that means that there is a decrease of particle size. So if you remove smectite component in interstratified elite smectite particles, you will have a decrease of the particle size. And we conclude that the apparent mineralogical change we could see is, an acidic decomposition of the structure in part, preferentially the low-charge monoionic layers. And so we can observe a relative increase of elitic, bedelitic layers, but these layers were already present at the beginning, so in the sea horizon. Okay, so now we will move to the clay synthesis. And I will show you two examples. Our requirement is the minimization of the variables of the system, because if we want to study, for example, one parameter, we need to have only one parameter varying. One requirement, too, is reproducibility, because as soon as we find the good way, it should be reproducible. And we want to have homogeneous and definite chemical, a sample with homogeneous and definite chemical composition, because it is the objective. And you can see here some starting material obtained in a way, and you can see that it is not good starting material, because even at this macroscopic scale, we can see heterogeneity, so this is not good starting material. This is the transmission electron microscopy scale, and this too is not a good starting material. And this is a good starting material, because we cannot, at the temperature we use, we need to have an homogeneous starting material to obtain an homogeneous final material. And to obtain this, the best technique is to use an amorphous gel with a clay stoichiometry and following the De Caro's protocol. And this is a basis reaction. So it is a gel co-precipitation with a silica source. Most often this is a metasilicate of sodium and some metal source, which is salts, either chlorides, nitrates, sulfates. And we need, sometimes we use equilibrated agent. So, for example, for carolinite, here, we use this reaction. And thus, we will obtain this co-precipitate with the stoichiometric composition of carolinite. So this is a basis reaction, but in fact, sometimes it does not work, because due to this, the pH of the co-precipitate is not necessarily adequate with the formation, with a good condition to the product we want to obtain. So in the past, when we used this reaction, and as Alain De Caro's used, we were lucky because, fortunately, using this reaction, it was good condition. But in some cases, it does not work. Okay, we will see. So after co-precipitation, the co-precipitate is centrifugal washed, dried and crushed, or freeze-dried. Sometimes it is used like that. And thus, the starting material is ready to use. So our aim is to reproduce in laboratory clay formation, but we cannot use geological times. And for example, this, so this is a calculated half reaction time, is totally incompatible with a PhD study. So we need to increase temperature just to make it compatible. But we measure and we observe after calorimetric measurement that this using temperature less than 250 degrees, we can obtain clay minerals totally similar, at least in the thermodynamical point of view, to natural Earth surface clay. So we use this type of reactor. And we I will illustrate carolinite synthesis and just influence of conditions of formation and also aluminium iron substitution. And we could synthesize carolinite under this condition, so temperature and pressure, so in a wide range of conditions. And from different starting materials, gel, glass, polycrystallized carolinite, metakaolin. And we could sort out the crucial role of pH in kaolinite characteristic. So in this case, we use as a starting material a co-precipitate gel, but aging 220 degrees for 2 weeks with spontaneous pH. That means that it is using the Carroll's reaction. And we obtain partially carbonatized gel. And we use it as starting material and change pH, just change pH, adjusted by with hydrochloric acid or soda. So that means that, so this is pH adjusted, but pH phenol were between 1 and 8. So this is a starting material. After 3 weeks at 220 degrees, so with no change of pH, we obtain this. At pH 1, you can see that there's a big crystal. pH 7, we can observe some elongated particles, and pH 8 is elongated particles. Clearly, so you can see clearly the role of pH. So this is an infrared spectra, and what we can see is an increase of cation exchange capacity of this synthetic kaolinite with an increase of pH. Okay, and we can have very high cation exchange capacity. In this case, this is variable charge. So a clear role of pH due to that. And this is a good example of, so just poisoning, we explain that with poisoning of the surface edge by cations adsorption. So this is a thermal analysis. We can see clearly difference between the sample. pH 1 is more thermally stable, and the thermal stability decreases with pH. And this is a X-ray diffraction pattern, and with a crystallinity index decreasing with the increase of pH. And as I already told you, all these kaolinites have thermodynamical functions similar to natural kaolinites. Now, the iron aluminium substitution. The problem of iron status with kaolinite is a long story one. So iron can be in admixture as iron oxide. Iron can be adsorbed, or it can be in a substitution in the octahedral sheet of kaolinite. Well, so we show that it was possible to synthesize iron kaolinite. So in this case, we use the basis reaction at this time. And so we showed that aluminium iron substitution are well evidenced by infrared. So this is in the near infrared region. You can see shoulder there. And we showed also that there was no correlation between iron content and kaolinite crystallinity. But more recent data show that it is possible to synthesize kaolinite with higher level of iron substitution. Just I show you some data. So this is a 060 reflection. And we can see clearly a change, a shift of the position. And we can calculate the B parameter. So this is a free new sample with a high level of iron substitution. So it was the petit N de Carroll's one. And so this is a new one. So we can see clearly an increase of the B parameter. So this is a clear proof that iron is incorporated into the structure. But in this case, too, the pH was a spontaneous pH 5. We can... A question arises, why iron contents are so low in natural kaolinites? So it would be interesting to study the kaolinite iron experimental system versus pH, because no changing the reaction basis. Now I will shift to smectat, which is another problem. It will be the last example. So this is a ternary diagram of octahedral composition for natural dioctahedral smectites. So tetrahedrally charged smectites are bedelite and nontronite. Bedelite is the aluminium end member, nontronite is the iron end member. And in the case of octahedrally charged smectites, you have momionite, aluminium magnesium, and iron momionite, which is iron, momion, iron and magnesium. These two chemical series were studied by Groby et al. Using the basis reaction of De Caro. So there was no problem to synthesize bedelite, saponite, or nontonite, saponite, smectite. But at this time, using this basis reaction, Groby was not able to synthesize this solid solution. He could, he was only able to synthesize one or two smectite in this compositional range. We can see also that in the natural system, there is no smectite, no point plot there. Okay, so why? Is it an actual chemical gap or not? So this nontonite end member was recently synthesized by in our lab, and we can obtain high charge nontonite. In this case, there is no aluminium, so that means that there is only iron in octahedra, and there is a tetrahedral substitution by iron. So this is a very high charge. They were synthesized from 75 to 150 degrees. And in this case, the range of synthesis pH was narrow from, okay, very, very basic, of course. At lower pH, hematite or isengerite are formed, and at higher pH and for temperature higher than 180, agerine is formed. So this is agerine. So I wanted to put this picture because it is rather rare to obtain pyroxene at so low temperature. What was important is that the expandability of the nontonite synthesized at these different temperatures was linked to their crystallinity or particle size, in fact, and thus linked to temperature of synthesis. And ranges from smectite to their mica-like behavior. So what is interesting that for the lower temperature samples, their behavior was not at all normal, in fact. Because for such ice charge, we should observe vermiculite-like behavior as this higher temperature one. And that's what I can we can deduce, that maybe these low temperature samples are, we can name them nanoparticles, because they are not the behavior they should have depending in regard to their crystal chemical properties. And now we are working on this chemical series. So putting some aluminium in this system there. So in the beginning, with few amount of aluminium, we will have tetrahedral alumina. And increasing the amount of aluminium, we will introduce aluminium in octahedra. So for such system, we have to change of the basis reaction because pH conditions are not good. So just, I will not force you to read this table, just to show you the number of trials. And here are just the trials put with the new thing that we have to adjust the pH of the coprecipitate to possible condition of formation of the smectite. And here are the successful smectite synthesis. So this is a different gel composition. In fact, it's not the actual gel composition. It is a stoichiometric amount of product we use to obtain the coprecipitate. And we change temperature. So what we know is that for iron-rich sample, we need to have temperature not higher than 150. But for aluminium system, we know that we have a temperature higher than 200 degrees. And for iron-rich sample, we need to have high pH. And for aluminium sample, we need to have lower pH. So we have to adjust all the parameters along the solid solution. And so this is a X-ray diffraction powder pattern. We can see that there are smectites. So we can recognize the smectite turbostratic reflection. So there are swelling clays, so under ethylene glycol solvation. So this is actually smectite. And now the 0633 reflection. So you can see that the value are rather high because they are dioctahedral. And we can have 1.553 angstrom. So this is very high for dioctahedral smectite. This is due for this high value to tetrahedral iron in tetrahedral iron. And I will show you these two samples because we can see clear difference in the 0633 reflection, that means that there is more iron than this sample and more aluminium than in this sample. And because they are with the same stoichiometric proportion. Okay. But the condition of pH, notably here, phenol pH, are totally different. So this sample with high pH led to iron smectite, and this sample with rather low pH led to aluminium smectite. And this is well followed with infrared. So this is in the near infrared region, combination bound region, OH combination bound region. So this band is due to iron-iron. This is a vacant site. This band is due to aluminium iron. So you can see that for intermediary sample, we have this band. And this band is due to aluminium-aluminium band. So we can obtain all the series. And this is a middle infrared region. I cannot resist to show you infrared spectra. So we can see clearly the change along the series. So iron and member, aluminium and member, and clearly change in the bending region. Okay. Thus, I will conclude about the relevance to use clay synthesis for environmental studies. So it is testing to determine the experimental conditions which led to mineral crystallization, even if it is in very simplified system, because it will help to constrain possible conditions of formation for those minerals. It is not so obvious. There is some recent application with a Martian problem. And we can see that pH conditions strongly control crystal chemistry of synthesized clays. It is also important to obtain good reference minerals with monitored crystal chemistry, to use them for spectroscopic fingerprints, because it's not so obvious to interpret spectra when we have natural clay minerals. To use them for laboratory experiments, redox, as you will see for the next lecture, sorption experiments and so on, and to use them for in situ experiments. I think this sample can be used for in situ experiment, and I will finish with this picture, which is one of my favorite colleagues who is there, Laurent Canet, pedologist, who is putting this synthetic nantonite in strategic site in a soil profile. So I will thank you for your attention.
The Grand Teton and the Idaho-Wyoming border, I put it up there because it reminds me of where I grew up in the view of this mountain, which I climbed. There I am many years ago on top of that Grand Teton. It's different to see the Earth while you're still standing on it than it is from an airplane. All right, well, the topic for my message to you today is the effects of iron redox cycles on smectite properties. I'd like to give a plug for my university, the University of Illinois, which is given in a fisheye lens photo here. Another couple of pictures. It was founded in 1867. By many of your standards, that's very new. In the United States, it's not the oldest, but it's been around for more than 130 years. These are the Morrow plots. This is the oldest continuously cultivated agricultural experimental field in the United States. And it's been continuously planted, cultivated in corn and soybean rotations with different fertilization treatments. Okay. Well, I would like to acknowledge the organizing committee. It's been a wonderful colloquium. I'm grateful for the opportunity to participate. I'd like to acknowledge students and colleagues who've contributed to this work throughout the years. Particularly in this presentation, I want to acknowledge Fabiana Ribeiro, Siouan Shen, and Lubos Jankovic, who all provided unpublished data that were collected in my lab that are included in this presentation. I also wish to acknowledge those agencies which have supported my research through the years. Well, the objectives of this presentation are first to demonstrate why iron and clay minerals should be included when we consider the solid phase in the environmental mineralogy. And also to describe, to help do that by describing some of the findings that are obtained when smectites are cycled from oxidized to reduced and then back to reoxidized states. Most of the work that's been done has focused on just this aspect of the process, going from the unaltered or oxidized state to the reduced state. And we have many results on that. There are fewer results on taking it the next step to reoxidized, and even fewer on the multiple cycles. So just to give you a refresher on the structure of the clay mineral layer so that we're all thinking alike, this is a drawing by one of my students of the 2-to-1 phyllosilicate layer, where you can see the tetrahedral sheet below and above, and in the middle, the octahedral sheet. At the corners of the tetrahedra are oxygen ions, and at the corners of the octahedra are oxygen ions and 2 hydroxyl groups. So the hydroxyls are coordinated to the octahedral sheet only. So you see the tetrahedral sheets and the octahedral sheet, and of course in this plane are oxygen ions, and in these interstices are silicon ions, but as Sabine pointed out, you can also have aluminum and ferric iron substituting for the silicon in the tetrahedral sheets. In the octahedra are aluminum and ferric if it's a dioctahedral structure, or if it's a trioctahedral structure, it requires the sites to be occupied by a divalent ion such as magnesium. And of course, you get all kinds of mixtures of these ions through this, which gives rise to the layer charge or the octahedral layer charge. The substitution of aluminum or iron in the tetrahedral sheet gives rise to the tetrahedral permanent charge. So what we're interested in is the ferric iron in the octahedral sheet being reduced to ferrous iron. And when that occurs, many changes take place in both the structure here and in the interlayer and the interactions with the cations that are exchanged here to neutralize the charge, and or with organic compounds or other agents that might interact with the clay surface. This region is a very rich chemical environment. It's accessible to the external solution. So whatever is in that mixture in the soil solution or in the laboratory has access to this region, so the interactions with these surfaces becomes very important. And just to give a little more background on the clay, one of the most important reasons to study iron in the clay minerals is because of its susceptibility to changes in oxidation state. And as I mentioned, it most commonly exists in the octahedral sheet. And when it is there, it is normally ferric iron, but exceptions to that are biotite, for example, the micas, which can have ferrous iron. Illite exists with ferrous iron. But interestingly, and as Sabine showed, that ferric iron can also exist in the tetrahedral sheet. Her result of an all ferric tetrahedral sheet is very unique, very interesting result. There is a native amount, natural amount of ferrous iron that exists in the smectite, depending on the smectite. We know more about the behavior of the iron in the octahedral sheet than we do in the tetrahedral sheet. Iron in the tetrahedral sheet is almost completely unstudied. Now, one reason to consider iron in phyllosilicates as part of this colloquium, and I don't know whether you're familiar with this, but we've measured the reduction potential of the clay with the iron in different ratios of ferrous and total iron, and we found that the reduction potential is greater than in goethite or hematite, which means that the iron in the phytosilicator in the smectite will be reduced before the oxides will be. Another reason to study it and consider this solid phase, the iron in this solid phase, is because the iron is not solubilized to any large extent. So we consider it to be largely immobile. So here's a graph showing those calculations. If we take an oxidized, this is a ferruginous smectite, has about 15% by weight ferric iron, a fairly low level of ferrous, so it's mostly oxidized. And so in the oxidized state, at an ionic strength of millimolar or tenths of millimolar, the reduction potential is up here. And so as the soil becomes reduced, here is the fallow state where it's more oxidized, but as it becomes submerged or oxygen becomes depleted, the EH goes down, and as it does, it will find alternative electron acceptors to oxygen, and the ferric iron in the smectite would be a prime candidate. So you'd reduce the iron here before you get down to goethite or hematite, depending on the pH, of course. Redox reactions are clearly among the most significant processes that occur in soils. They're common within and among all of the inorganic, organic, and biological systems. Microbial respiration is of particular interest because that is the principal promoter of redox changes of iron in the clay minerals in the soil, we believe. Now I'd like to review the properties of the clays that are altered when the iron is reduced from ferric to ferrous. One of the first observations we made about that was a change in layer charge. As ferric receives an electron, that automatically should increase the negative charge on the layer. Interestingly enough, it does not follow a one-to-one process like you might expect. In other words, the layer charge only increases at a rate of about one-third of the number of electrons that are pumped into it. So there is clearly a change, other changes that must take place in the layer to compensate the charge. So it isn't a direct one-to-one relationship. And associated with the increase in layer charge is both an increase in cation exchange capacity and an increase in the cation fixation capacity. I assume you know what fixation is, but to be clear, it is where the cation becomes trapped between the clay layers and is no longer available for exchange. I'll show a little more information about the fixation. Reduction promotes the collapse of superimposed clay layers, and that causes a decrease in the swelling in water and the specific surface area, and it also impacts the fixation capacity for cations. Here's an example. If we have the interlayer cation in the oxidized state, the layers are generally fully swelling. Well, upon reduction, some of them collapse, trapping a certain fraction of the cations. Where potassium is the interlayer cation, we know about a third of the exchange capacity is removed through the collapse of the interlayers. However, we can preclude that collapse if we insert a large alkyl ammonium cation, for example, that then the layers do not collapse and the potassium remains exchangeable. We've also found that the particle size and the thickness and the length of the particles are changed. The thickness increases and the length of the particle decreases. So that the particles become, instead of being long and thin, or broad and thin, they are more stubby or short and blocky in their dimensions. Surface hydration energy increases, and that's an interesting story because swelling decreases, but the actual hydration energy of a given surface increases. The hydraulic conductivity can be altered, and that depends, the direction of the change depends on whether reduction occurs before compaction or after compaction. And the color changes, which reveals things about the relationship between the iron ions within the clay layer. And here's an example. This is from a bentonite mine in Wyoming, and where the caterpillar with a big claw on the back was able to dig down underneath to expose the underlying clay from the bottom of the mine. And you see how the color is different underneath than it is up on the surface. And this, we believe this change in color is due to a reduced state of the iron. The distribution of the iron within the clay layer is also changed when reduction takes place. We did some work with Alain Monceau and Victor Dritz, where we concluded, based on polarized XAFs, that the iron migrates from a cis site to a trans octahedral site during reduction. The extent of that depends upon the extent of reduction. The surface pH is increased. Magnetic exchange interactions are altered, and the smectite becomes activated toward the degradation of organic compounds. This includes nitroaromatics, chlorinated aliphatics, and aromatics. And it also affects pesticide toxicity. We performed a study where we measured the effect of oxidized clays and reduced clays on the cytotoxicity of pesticides and the genotoxicity. Only a few studies have focused on the redox cycles, as I mentioned before. And even fewer have investigated cycles that go beyond the first one. So I'd like to spend most of the rest of the talk showing how, comparing reduced and reoxidized systems. Because in the soils, clearly they're subjected to many redox cycles. And I didn't even try to contemplate how many through the ages. But any soil that you go to has been literally through billions of cycles of redox. So today's present-day soils are really the product of many of those cycles rather than being the pristine soil from the beginning. And these are still going on. Methods of reduction, just briefly say, dithionite is the reducing agent that's used in the laboratory. But in 1986, we started using bacteria as well and have found interesting results from that. So let's focus now on the changes in color. And we'll do this showing some UV-Vis spectra in the visible region so you can see how this is tracked spectroscopically. And the foundation for the UV-Vis measurement, if we start out thinking of the octahedral sheet being complete with ferric iron, if we then convert some of them to ferrous iron, we set up an exchange interaction between electron hopping from the ferrous iron through the oxygen to the ferric iron. So you can see that process going on. And as that takes place, that has a resonance in the visible region around 700 nanometers. So we can, and then it can go backwards. So you can have that process, and it manifests itself in these differences in color. Of course, here's an oxidized nontranite, here is a reduced one. So it goes from yellow to green to blue-green to dark gray or to light gray. And here you can see some of the more gray colors that occur. And this is not, and the grayer colors are more reduced than the blue-green. And we can track that following that intervalence electron transfer band. This is the visible spectrum of an unaltered ferruginous smectite, and you can see kind of there's some features in there. But as you reduce it, then this big broad band appears, and that's due to an intervalence transfer transition. And you can pick an arbitrary wavelength somewhere in this range to track that. As you go become more reduced, you see that increases. And if we were to follow this change in intensity with time as reduction proceeds, we get initially an increase, but then when it goes back toward reoxidation, then it decreases. And Peter Comedel did that and followed it in this way, where we monitored the absorbance at 730 nanometers. And so you can see that it increases till it reaches a maximum. And because this absorbance is due to intervalence transfer, it really depends on the number of pairs of ferrous and ferric that are adjacent in adjacent sites. So you can imagine as you increase ferrous content, initially you're increasing the ferrous-ferric pairs, but you'll reach a maximum. After reduction proceeds to a certain point, you're now going to have ferrous-ferrous pairs and will be losing intensity from this transition. So that's in fact what you observe, and it just continues until you get here. And then if the purge gas is changed from nitrogen to oxygen, then that process reverses as we're now oxidizing, getting more ferric iron, more ferrous-ferric pairs, till we pass the maximum, and now we're getting ferric-ferric pairs out here until we reach a reoxidized state. So looking at this diagram, it appears that the change in color is largely reversible. It's not totally, but it's largely reversible. And it's an easy way to track those color changes. This was carried out with dithionite, where we can achieve virtually, this is about 96% reduced of the ferric iron has been reduced at this stage. If we do it with bacteria, this is what the pattern looks like. So you see again we get that increase, but we didn't get that big drop down here. It reached a maximum, then came to a valley, and then went back up. And then on reoxidation, then it came back. So there's something different in the way the pattern of a bacterial reduction compared to dithionite reduction. And I'll say more about that in a minute. There's the unaltered for another clay. I won't spend more time on this. But there is a band due to tetrahedral ferric iron that you can observe in this one that then you can reduce it and reoxidize it and that somewhat lose this tetrahedral ferric band. So upon reduction, be interesting to study that further. All right, so those color changes go from yellow to blue to gray. Other features also change due to oxygen ferric charge transfer being lost. It appears to be largely reversible with reoxidation. Restoration of ferric is almost complete. There's some clays that is not, such as Upton montmorillonite. If tetrahedral ferric is present, it can be observed. And the redox mechanisms between dithionite and bacteria are different to some degree. Now I want to look at the cation fixation and redox cycling. What happens if we take this and reoxidize it? Does it re-expand and release the potassium? And we've done cation fixation with a number of cations. And so let's look at some redox cycles. So here's the cycle numbers. I just take it out to 5. This is the ferrous to total iron ratio. So as we proceed up, we're becoming more reduced. This is the unaltered state. And as we go to the middle of the first cycle, we reduce the iron. And you see we're going to about 50% reduction in this experiment. When we reoxidize it, we come only back to here. We don't come clear back to here. And this, I should say, is in the presence of potassium. So then if we take it through another cycle, we increase it, and you see the trend over time is that the amount of ferrous iron in the reoxidized sample is steadily increasing, and the extent to which we can reduce it is decreasing. If we extend that out to where they intercept, that would be about 10 cycles. So if the Earth's been through a billion redox cycles, you can see we're way past 10. Now let's look at what happens to the potassium. Now that's on this axis. This is the amount of potassium fixed. See, we start out where it's low, but it immediately goes up. This is in the reoxidized state. I didn't put the reduced state. But in the reoxidized state, the amount of fixed potassium steadily is increasing. And so if you plot fixed potassium versus the ferrous iron content, you can see that with you, as you increase the number of redox cycles, you're increasing both the residual ferrous and the residual fixed potassium in the sample, which looks a lot like an illite, because you have fixed potassium and you have residual ferrous iron, and the sample is less expandable. Well, now let's look at some changes given by FTR and MOSPAR spectroscopy. These are spectra collected by Dongfang Ho and Claire Fialops, and they illustrate the hydroxyl stretching bands in Garfield nontronite, which the original and altered sample looks like this. When we reduce it, here's the unaltered structure. When we reduce some of the iron, it gives one pattern, but we can reduce it even further, and when we get complete reduction, this is what Monceau reported, is all of these defects start to be created as an iron moves from a cis site, which was formerly here, to a trans site, which was formerly vacant. Then you create these cavities, and you've dehydroxylated the structure, perhaps with some reprotonation of these edges. As this proceeds, you see that this band, we're losing structural OH, but we have two other features happening. One is we're getting a small band here, which is consistent with a trioctahedral environment for the hydroxyl group, and which would be consistent with that migration from cis to trans sites. And we're also getting a very large, highly adsorbed, strongly bound water band here in this region. And that would be consistent then with a ferrous iron moving to this site and to that site, creating a defect there. And so this one would move over, and it dehydroxylates right there. And then as you protonate those edges, then maybe that strongly bound water is right in here with a double protonation of some oxygens. And now upon reoxidation, in the unaltered, or when we plot unaltered and reoxidized together, you see a small amount of reduction shifts it to here, but then it goes right back. So we reduce it more, then you start to see some differences, and even more reduction. Now you're seeing that water band, you're seeing that trioctahedral band, but the reoxidized spectrum is different. And when you get down to here, then it doesn't preserve that bound water. A lot of it is lost, and so the reoxidation does return some of the structural OH, and we have not yet modeled the structure for what that we think that would look like. Dithionite reduction therefore causes rather drastic changes in the structure depending on the extent of reduction. I might comment that bacteria reduce the iron to about that first level. MOSPAR spectroscopy gives us a little bit more information, and in particular allows us to compare dithionite reduction with bacteria reduction. The infrared showed virtually no difference when you take into account the extent of reduction that has occurred. In MOSPAR spectroscopy, this central peak represents the structural ferric iron in an octahedral environment. These little bumps out here are due to some goethite impurity. So it'd be this structure. When we reduce it to about that first level of the infrared, which appeared to be quite reversible, you notice we've got this flaring is an indication of the onset of some magnetic order, but it's not fully developed. But you do see a peak for ferrous iron here. The rest of this would be ferric iron. So it would be this type of a structure, we think. And so comparing the reduced to the unaltered, you see the differences. If we reoxidize this one, we've removed that goethite impurity, which would be expected, and then we have just a single doublet for the octahedral ferric iron. Now, comparing it with bacteria reduced to about that same level, which in the infrared appeared to be very similar, notice the difference, that it's a very different MOSPAR spectrum compared to the dithionite reduced, even though we're at the same reduction level. And when we reoxidize it, though, it looks very similar to the dithionite spectrum. So there's something different in this. As the total level of reduction is achieved, notice the pattern, and we have yet to succeed in doing a good fit on this, but notice that you see remnants of this in here. You might can imagine that you've got the mixture of some of this and maybe some of that in it. And what we think is happening, that this is a totally ferrous domain and magnetically interacting as ferrous irons, but you can, in this case, you've got that domain, and but you also have a ferric domain, magnetically interacting ferric domain. In this case, the iron is widely distributed, so you don't get much domain structure for the magnetic interactions. When you reoxidize this one, you see you give a very different spectrum. I'll come back to that in just one second. I just want to come back here. So what we think is happening in the difference between bacteria and dithionite reduced is that the dithionite reduced did it kind of randomly within the structure. But we think the bacteria are doing it from the edge of the clay layer, and it's essentially driving a reducing front through the layer. So you do get a domain of ferrous iron, but you have a residual domain of ferric iron. And that's more consistent with this type of a structure if you think you've got two discrete domains, ferrous and ferric, whereas here the domain structure doesn't develop much. This appears to be very different from this. So upon reoxidation of the fully reduced sample, we have clearly similar to what we found with the infrared. All right, so there's that fully reduced structure again. So just to conclude, I'll make these few remarks. That redox activation of the clay minerals surely must play a major role in environmental chemistry of minerals. And major changes are observed in the physical and in the chemical and, in fact, in the surface properties of the clays. And these, when redox cycles are invoked, mineral transformations also occur, but the extent of those depends on the initial reduction level and upon the interlayer cation. And bacteria are the principal agent for redox activation of clay minerals in the environment. So thank you all for your attention.
Vous venez d'écouter les interventions de Joseph Stocky, Sabine Petit et Emmanuel Fritsch dans le cadre du colloque sur la minéralogie environnementale qui avait lieu les 14 et 15 septembre 2009. Vous pouvez également écouter la première partie de ce colloque sur le site de Canal Académie. Merci pour votre écoute et à bientôt pour de prochaines retransmissions.